This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Pierre, thank you so much for making time for this. I'm very grateful and honored to have you on the show.
Of course. My pleasure. Thank you. I'm a follower, a big fan. So it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, I appreciate it. So I guess the first thing I wanted to get your thoughts on is it feels like your era of pop punk has been having a moment for the past couple of years. But I think even right now, I feel like it's at absolute peak. I don't know, it's not even nostalgia. It's appreciation, I guess I would say, because it's not just nostalgia, because there's a lot of, younger people into it too. How do you feel about that? And what do you think is behind all that?
It's interesting. There's been a bit of a revival. I think it started, a few years ago, kind of when artists like Machine Gun Kelly kind of brought back the style a little bit, and, Travis Barker started producing all these records. And I feel like, it did. I mean, there's definitely, a difference. There was, for us, we started, our band came out in 2002, and that was the peak. We were almost at the tail end of it, because when we got signed, our record label was you might be too late on this wave of pop punk. Right. So anyways, and then it became popular for a while. Then there was a lull for sure. I mean, the scene has always been around. Vans Warped Tour has always been a success through all those years. But on the mainstream, it definitely kind of dipped down and other styles kind of took over. It's interesting. There's the wave that sort of, like I said, began with Machine Gun Kelly, and that sort of new era has kind of, stuck around. It's still there. And as you're saying, it's almost like at its peak. I'm not really sure why. I think maybe, I think the appreciation of the emo scene and how easily that goes well hand in hand with memes. Feel like the meme culture has helped has helped keep that in the forefront of people's minds. I can't really pinpoint exactly what it is, but I guess a lot of great songs, a lot of great songs have come out from the early 2000s, bands like Blink-182 who are they're now, Tom just got back and now they're back on tour. So that also helps the whole thing. There's so many little factors here and there. A lot of bands like mine and, Yellow Card came back and bands that are touring more. I know we were on tour a lot with Sum 41 last year, and they've just announced that they're, disbanding. So that almost creates more excitement. So there's a lot of things, I think at the base of it all is that there's songs that are meaningful to people, that have impacted them in a deep way, that so deeply that they remain fans for a lifetime. That's what I find is the most interesting thing about our scene, and even our band particularly. I think that we've been able to write songs and connect with a fan base so deeply that they're the kind of people that they're I love this band when I was 13, 14, 15, 18, whatever it was. But the songs meant so much to me at that time that if I hear them when I'm 50, I'm still going to feel yes. So I think that's a big factor. But all those things together, but it's cool. And then there was also the TikTok, I'm just a kid phenomenon. So all those things kind of created a perfect storm where today you see the early 2000s pop punk be more present than it was 10 years ago. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned MGK, which I think is interesting because a lot of people really don't want to give him credit. But I mean, there's no question about it. Whether you like him or his music or not is a whole other question. But I mean, the fact of the matter is Tickets to My Downfall was a Billboard number one album. You can't deny that. He really did bring the genre back to the forefront in a way that nobody else had. in a long time.
And really quick, before we go any further, have you checked out my Patreon? Patrons get early access to all my main channel videos and my podcasts. I also do giveaways sometimes. For example, I just gave away a pair of these Eargasm earplugs. And if you want me to review your music, there's a way to do that as well. All you gotta do is join at the $10 and up level. Then every month I do a call for submissions. If you want me to review something, all you gotta do is drop it in the comments of that post. Then I will review it live on Twitch and post it on Patreon for everyone to see. So if that sounds cool, hit the link in the description of this video, and I appreciate your support.
Yeah, I agree. I give him credit for that. I think that I think he's got some great songs. There's just like any artist, there are some songs of his that I don't appreciate as much, but like I'm sure people say the same thing about my music.
Sure.
But yeah, there's some great stuff, and he did definitely he kind of brought back pop punk with a flavor that wasn't really as prominent before. Like he was more into hip hop, and like his singing is more kind of like low talking. And but it really, you know, that sparked all of his stuff with Travis Barker, and then, you know, all the other stuff came around. So yeah, I definitely give him credit for reigniting something that we can all appreciate now, you know.
The other thing he did, which I want to ask you about I have lots of questions about this, but the other thing he did that I think a lot of people maybe don't appreciate is he put it back in the mainstream of pop culture. Because remember, you know, people think of your era of pop punk as being this sort of like, I don't know, I don't want to say underground thing, but a big part of it is like, you know, you had a show on MTV, Travis had shows on MTV. Like this was not underground stuff. It was as mainstream as it gets. And I think that's really important. It's a good thing. MGK, you know, is in TMZ and stuff and put it back in the mainstream spotlight.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you don't, you know, and I'm not trying to be boastful or anything, but you don't sell 2.5 or whatever, almost 3 million copies of an album by remaining underground. You know,
it's definitely impossible.
When we came out, even before that, like Blink-182 was zero underground. That was like everybody knew who that was. And
right.
So, you know, when Sum 41 came out, and then us, and then Wilco Charlotte also, those three bands to me were like, we wrote on their on Green Day and Blink-182's coattails, but absolutely it was not underground whatsoever. It was MTV, TRL, it was Billboard charting stuff, and it was I think it's a good thing. And listen, I understand the feeling of having of wanting to keep something secret to yourself. I understand that. Listen, I was a teenager at some point, and I remember in my first, you know, my first band, which was with Chuck, you know, my drummer in Simple Plan. I remember writing a song because I was a big fan of Green Day, and then Green Day blew up, and it kind of upset me. I was like, I don't want the girls in my class in high school to sing Green Day. This is my band, you know. But you know, with a little more age and maturity, I understand that that's part of the journey. And I think it is a good thing that it becomes mainstream, because you want to see those acts be successful. Because what does success do to an act? Well, success allows you to focus on it more and to dedicate your life to something and not having to have another job. You know, like when I was in my first punk band, a band called Reset, I didn't make enough money to barely pay for instruments. So would that have continued? Probably not. At some point, reality would have stepped in and been like, hey, you can't afford to do this. So I do agree that it's a good thing that MGK brought this back in the mainstream. And, you know, there are some pros and cons about that. But I think, it's definitely, as you mentioned, it wasn't an underground thing. It was definitely you know, as much as people might want to think that like it was this little subculture, it wasn't a subculture. Even though it was a subculture, it was huge, you know?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned TRL, which I am absolutely obsessed with that show. And I just made a video about it. I'm dedicated to like spreading the gospel of TRL because I think it was amazing. You were on there quite a bit.
Yep.
I want to know everything about being on TRL. What was that like?
You know, it's funny for me because all those early years of the band, and I've been in a band for probably 6 years before that, but we got, you know, relatively quick success with Simple Plan, and all those experiences, I wish I could go back and relive them again, because it went by so fast, and it was so like, they're going here. We were in Times Square. We were, I mean, we'd go to New York all the time because our label was there. and we'd be going to TRL every couple of months. And I have to say, it was an awesome time. Everyone there was super cool. It was this big production thing. You'd walk up to MTV, get checked all your security stuff, go in there, have your little green room, have your food. Like, okay, you'll be on like 15 minutes and go to makeup. And it was like, it was a cool little thing. We even played MTV's, I think it was 2003 or 2004, the New Year's Eve batch, where we played in the studios as the ball dropped. So we were there all the time. But it was super fun. All of the VJs were super nice. We had a great time. And I have to say, I have to give credit, because I believe, well, I don't believe, this is a fact. Simple Plan has a lot. One of the big reasons why we became successful was because MTV backed us before radio. Like, it was a time when MTV had the power to break a band, and with us, they really did. We had the support of it. We had a great guy at Lava Records named Doug Cohn, who he was the guy that took care of all the VH1 MTV stuff, and he pushed us at MTV. And the MTV execs were like, "We like this band. We're going to play them." And they played them. They played us before we had any success, and that kind of fueled everything else. So yeah, TRL was something that I look back with a lot of gratitude and a lot of cool experiences. We met Tom Hanks on TRL, saw a lot of cool celebrities. So it was really fun.
And I think Carson,
quiet down. My dogs are being shh.
That's busy.
Yeah.
Carson was actually like a fan of punk, right?
Yeah, he was super cool. Carson Daly was awesome. We met him a bunch of times. Who's the other guy? I'm drawing a blank right now. Damien, who now writes for Family Guy. Damien was I don't forget what his last name was, but Damien was an awesome host too. And we became friends and went out and had drinks in New York. And so there was a lot of cool people there. But yeah, they all were super supportive. And it was a real tight-knit family there that were, in my experience, all really nice people.
I just thought it was amazing to see. You know, I mean, I remember Newfound Glory when, you know, Chad was in the hardcore scene and stuff like that. And then to see all your bands, you know, on TRL and Times Square with crowds of screaming teenagers in front of it. Like, I thought that was fucking cool, because I felt like it was like my people winning.
Yeah, no, I think it's awesome. You know, and like I said, there's the punk rock elite that will, you know, frown on those kind of things. But I think it was great. It was a great time. And I think it gave birth to a lot of awesome bands. And I think that, like you said, people may want to think that it was all underground stuff, but it was definitely hitting the mainstream, you know, and that's why, you know, that type of success is what fueled successful tours like the Pop Disaster Tour, which was Green Day and Blink-182, which we had the honor to open for, but we didn't, at the time we were so new that we didn't get to play on the stage. We played in the parking lot because it was it was amphitheaters, and they were all sold out, like probably 15 to 20,000 people, if not more, every night. And we went on that tour for like 3-4 weeks. And we got to play, like, they would find a place for us at the amphitheater, whether it's the parking lot or like the concession stands, and they would stick a stage up and we played there. And that was also another reason why we made it. Like, but those experiences to me are all, you know, we're all possible because of the success of these bands and that music and that style.
Yeah, they couldn't put you on unless they were playing these like giant shows and had the ability to take a chance on a smaller band.
Exactly. Yeah. Boys, quit it. Jeez. Stop it.
He looks guilty.
Yeah, yeah.
Another thing that seems like it was a big part of your success is you guys were involved in a whole lot of these, I guess I would say, like teen movies in the beginning. Like, there was Freaky Friday and The New Guy, and it seems like that gave you a really big boost. Was that like a deliberate strategy on the part of you and your team, or did it just happen, or where did that come from?
Yeah, we were digging hard for those. I mean, we had another great component of Lava Records Kevin Weaver, who's still in the movie business and the movie music business. And he was a hustler. And for Lava, he was placing all these acts everywhere. And at the time, I really do believe that movie placements were, especially certain movie placements, were really incredible for people's career. Like, to be on an American Pie. Like, we were on American Pie, and it was like, to be on American Pie was like the golden ticket. We didn't make it on that one. I think we might have been on the second one, but I'm not sure. But all those placements, I mean, back in those days, music in movies was like, you know, soundtracks were huge. People would buy soundtracks, and that's how they would discover bands, you know. And also I feel that that style of music in those movies, it was like more of a, when the song came onto the movie, it was more impactful. Where now I think that the style of music that people use for ads and for movies is more, a little bit more like, you know, kind of background music. Yeah. And I say that with all due respect, because I do listen to stuff that I would consider to be more background music, but I'm a huge fan of
sure.
bands like, you know, Crying Bin. I don't even know how you say that name, but back in the day, yeah, like those soundtracks, The New Guy for us was huge. They paid for the video. And all those placements. I think we had, like, back in those days, we had like 180 different musical placements and movies and TV shows. We were the theme song for I'm forgetting now. It was some MTV show about high school life or college life. I forget what it was. Those placements were huge, you know. So it
made so much sense, because the stuff you guys were writing, to your point earlier, the stuff you guys were writing about was the same stuff they were making the movies about. And so when that song came on, it was like, it was about the situation in the movie or the TV show. And so it really just like set that emotional tone.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was a big thing. And it was a different time, and movies and music in TV had a different role back then, you know?
Right.
Like
right.
Blink had a lot of big placements and just all those bands. And I think, like I said, like to be, if you were able to be, hold on a second, someone's calling me. I have to, and this is, why do they do this? No. Send a voicemail. Do you still see me all right?
Yes, sir.
Yep. Okay, sorry.
Banish to voicemail.
Yeah, there you go. So they were just a big, big part of discovering bands, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. Still to this day, I was like, when they did American Pie, I was like, why didn't they put us on?
I would have been a perfect choice.
Yeah, yeah. And then you got those different connections. Like we did a lot of late night TV shows were a big thing back then too. Mm-hmm. If you were on Conan, we did Conan a bunch of times. We did Kimmel, which we awesome people there. But we never got David Letterman, because apparently there was someone that booked the Letterman thing that did not like Simple Plan. I don't know what we ever did, but that was one we never nailed. But
maybe there's still time.
Yeah.
Who knows? That's kind of my theory about what's driving a lot of this revival is I think there was, they call it like a monoculture back then. You know, there was this, it was an era of media where everyone knew about the same stuff. Like if there was a big movie out, even if you didn't care about the movie, you knew about it. Or like, for mm-hmm. example, you remember Jennifer Aniston's haircut on Friends, the Rachel. Right.
Yeah.
Everyone knew about that. Whether you watched Friends or not, everyone knew about Jennifer Aniston's haircut.
Yeah.
Now, because everyone has their own feed on social media and stuff like that, like we're not watching the same culture. And so I don't think it's possible to build stars like we did back then.
Well, you know, the reality is that I think that back in those days, the most of our culture, most of our pop culture was controlled by these big corporations,
right?
And they got to pick what was going to be popular or what exactly. they're going to focus on. Where now, like you're saying, there's a lot more, there's a lot of different channels, there's different ways for you to promote yourself, which is great from an artist's point of view because you have more opportunity. But you know, it's the result is that there's a lot more noise out there, a lot more stuff going on. Whereas back then, it was like, yeah, like if you were able to get your foot through the door, then you had a chance of being really, really big. I'll put my dogs outside. Sure. They're annoying the crap out of me. You boys are insane. Go outside. Go. Go, go, go. Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem.
I figured I would bring them inside so they wouldn't scratch up my door and then they just annoy the crap out of me.
being a dog dad, it's tough business. Yeah. So
yeah, you got dogs, right?
We have cat.
Oh, you have cat. Nice. I've got a cat too. I've got a cat, three dogs, and 11 chickens.
Wow. Okay. A lot of chickens.
Yeah, yeah. It's a zoo over here.
You know, to your point earlier about sort of this like fragmentation, you know, there's artists now that I look up on Spotify that have billions of streams and I've never heard of them.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's
this is weird. You know, we're watching different movies now.
It's true. And I question whether that is because there's many different channels and which we're not obviously following them all, or is it because we're just getting older? You know, like they're,
it's
you know,
both
like,
for sure.
Yeah, it's a bit of both, you know. So it's but yeah, it's there's definitely a lot of artists out there that, I mean, I just watch like the, if you watch the Grammys, I'm like, who's that?
Right.
And obviously they're doing really well.
And we are older, but yeah. You know, you're a professional musician. It's not like you're disconnected right. from what's happening in music.
True. To a certain extent. I kind of stay in my bubble sometimes, and I don't try to purposely educate myself to what's hot right now. I just kind of like stick to my own.
Yeah. One of the things I really liked about Simple Plan is that I think of you guys as being kind of the most, I would say, G-rated of the big pop punk bands, which yep. I really liked, just because to me it's really refreshing to hear something that's not super dark and cynical and edgy. Do you agree with that? And if so, was that like a deliberate decision on your part?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, I'm not afraid to admit it. We're definitely on the pop punk list of bands. We're definitely on the poppier side.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure what to attribute that to. I remember, you know, when I was younger, I was in a band that was like a metal punk band, because my guitar player was a guy that lived down the street from Chuck's house. And we went to the same high school, and he was a death metal fan. He was like,
are you talking about Reset or something else?
Yeah, Reset. Yeah.
Yeah. Very metal.
Yeah. Very metal. Because my guitar player literally was only able, not as that's rude. He was most comfortable playing because he listened to Deicide. He listened to, you know, Megadeth or whatever. I don't even know what to listen to, but he was really into metal. So all of our songs sounded really, really, really metal. But when we kind of disbanded and formed Simple Plan, I was a huge fan of, you know, Green Day, Blink-182 and their success. And I was like, this is so awesome. I want to do stuff like that. And I really loved strumming and being more poppy. But it's funny because, you know, we are very, very pop. And sometimes I wish that my writing wasn't so pop. But over the years, I've come to realize that when something comes out of me, whether it's on the piano or the guitar, I write melodies that they're just really melodic and very poppy. And, you know, if you combine that with not swearing, which we usually don't do, it just sounds more pop. And it's almost like sometimes it bugs me, because I'm like, man, I listen to other things and I'm like, oh, like I love Thrice. I think that Thrice is amazing. I love that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't love all of their stuff, and like same as any other artist. But like for me, Artist in the Ambulance was one of the best records of all time. I still listen to it to this day. And I think if I tried to write that, it wouldn't come out like that. Like I'm just more melodic in a poppier way. And it's just who I am. And was it intentional? I think to a certain degree, when Chuck and I shifted from Reset to Simple Plan, there was an absolute intentional, let's go to something more poppy because we like that. Because, you know, I like, you know, what Blink-182 is doing, and then na 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 na, all the small, like that was, that was like, this is awesome. So, but in trying to emulate them, Simple Plan, you know, was born. So it's interesting how it's like, was it intentional to a certain degree, but not like trying to be like, let's be squeaky clean. Like, it's just like, sometimes I feel like I'm too clean even for myself. Like I listen to my music from back in the day, and I'm like, oh man, I wish we had done it this way, or I wish it was more. And also I have to say, with some hindsight, our first producer was Arnold Lanny, who was not a pop punk producer whatsoever. He was not a pop punk writer. He was not a pop punk producer. And he had come from the absolute pop world. He was in a band called Sheriff. He was in a band called Frozen Ghost. He was a singer, piano player. And he produced big records in Canada for Our Lady Peace, which is a massive band.
Yeah.
And we loved the production for Our Lady Peace. And we're like, okay. And when we landed our deal with our management company, they worked with Arnold because it was kind of a relationship there. So we had a deal where he was going to produce the record. When we got signed, it was already set. And we're like, okay, well, he's not really pop punk, but we love Our Lady Peace, so it's going to sound great. But the result of it is that our first record, to me, you know, no pun intended, lacks a bit of balls. Like it's the sound of it. I mean, I was more into what Jerry Finn was doing, and I was more into other bands' sound. But we had done a deal where he'd helped us with the demos, and he was going to produce a record, and that was the way it was. So it kind of set us apart in our sound. Like our sound sounds a little bit different than everybody else's, and probably cleaner and poppier. Yeah. And that has a bit to do with Arnold's sort of aesthetic, and even to the way he wanted me to sing, and the way he kind of like directed me to sing. And that's why I think you see a big leap after our first album to our second album, which we kind of felt like, oh man, that was so pop, and like the drums don't sound bombastic and the guitars aren't as powerful as we wanted to. So we're on the second record, even though we had a deal with Arnold that he was supposed to make the second record, we sort of renegotiated and went with Bob Rock, because we're like, right, you know, we're like, we
did the Black album and stuff like that for anybody who may not know.
And he did like American Hi-Fi, and he'd done some more pop punk stuff. But we're like, man, we lack that heaviness and that energy. So let's go with someone else, you know. But yeah, so kind of a long circle around your question. Was it intentional to be poppy a little bit? But I think that it just happened organically with Arnold and yeah, just my songwriting. Like even to this day, like when I write for Simple Plan, or if I write for somebody else, sometimes I look back and at the end result of what I've created, I'm like, God damn, it's so catchy. Sometimes it's like annoyingly catchy. And I'm like, I wish, like I said, I'm a fan of things that are more late, not more chill and abstract. And like, even lyrically, like I'm a fan of stuff that's like a little more, not so on the nose, but yet my writing always seems to fall on the nose, and it's just the way I am. Yeah.
Well, that's what I liked about it. It took me a little bit at first, 'cause I was expecting it to be, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, more punk, but then I was like, okay, this is pop punk, you know? And then I really liked it after I just sort of reoriented. I had expectations and I reoriented. I was like, okay, this is closer to Backstreet Boys than it is to NOFX.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
And I love pop. So I think that's one of the strongest records of that whole era.
Well, thank you.
For that exact reason.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what I have to keep telling myself, because I think as an artist, you look back at your art, and a lot of times, like I look back at it, and if I'm somewhere and my first album is playing somewhere, I have to run away. I'm like, oh my God, I can't like, and it's, but I have to understand that the numbers speak for themselves. There was a lot of fans. That was our most successful record. Sure. It has to do with the era, but I mean, people to this day come to our shows because of that first album. And, you know, maybe then it introduced them to the rest of the catalog. But like, you know, it's a great record. And, you know, I was in a writing session with Chad Tepper, a buddy of mine who I became friends with, and Mitchie Collins, who's the singer for Lovely the Band. And he was like, oh, yeah, man, it's like your first record. He's like, I'd do anything. And he started playing the riff. And I'm like, holy shit, like, you're a band who I think is more on the, you know, more hip, more cool. And you like that record, so it's all good.
It feels like you kind of went back to that a little bit with, I forget the one from 2016. I forget the name of that album, but it feels like you kind of went back to that a little bit.
Yeah, Get Your Heart On.
Yeah, I was like, this just feels like an updated version of the first album, which is a really hard thing to pull off, because it's whatever, you know, 15, 20 years later, you're different people, you're not kids anymore. And it really worked.
Yeah. It was a great record for us. And I think we consciously, you know, the sort of the arc of the band's career, you know, we came out swinging with no pads. And because I think we were at that point, we were all kind of seasoned music writers, and not seasoned, but like we had some experience. And the reason why that record became so big as our debut is because we had experience in, you know, in indie bands and stuff. We're like, you know, we want this to be big. But the arc was really, that first record blew up. We were lucky enough to have a sophomore record that also did really well, multi-platinum around the world. And then our third record was a tough one, because the whole musical landscape had changed. And, you know, you didn't see bands like us or even Blink or Green Day being on the top of the charts anymore. And it kind of became, you know, now we're looking at like Timbaland production kind of stuff and Nelly
Right.
Furtado and Justin Timberlake. And it kind of threw us for a curveball because we're like, what do we do now? Like, and then you also, as an artist at that point, you start to ask yourself, like, okay, do we need to change? How do we prove that we're more than just Simple Plan, you know,
yeah.
which is an interesting thing. But so the third record was kind of a flop because not only did the industry kind of, you know, turn its head away from pop punk, but it just didn't do super well. So by the time the fourth record came out,
it was the emo hair. That's what did it.
Totally. It was the take yourself too seriously, wear button up shirts and put your hair like this. And it screwed us. Although now what's funny is that the biggest Simple Plan fans will always say that's their favorite record. So
I can see that.
Yeah. But anyways, so our fourth record, we really wanted to sort of like ignore that. And by the way, I think I might be mixing up records here. 2016 was not Get Your Heart On. It was Taking One for the Team.
I'm bad at remembering album names, so I apologize.
Yeah, but to me, they're very similar because at that point, I'm thinking about 2011 probably. At that point, we decided we're no longer going to like try to prove that we're something different because fans right. that like Simple Plan fell in love with I'm sorry, I can't be perfect. They want that again.
Yeah.
And I understand that. And I.
Welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind. And right now you're going to be getting a little taste of it, right down to the shaky microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name's Patrick. And usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work. But we talk about decidedly not so grown up things like
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from a niche music podcast that you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life and then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers. Think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe to Grind podcast.
And I feel like there are some artists that, you know, look at their success and say, I'm not doing that anymore. Screw that. I'm going to do something. And we've kind of done that for a minute.
Which I think is really...
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
Ultimately a selfish thing.
Yeah, you know? I mean, I'm not going to slam anyone for doing that because I think, you know, a lot of bands, I follow Billy Corgan and he explains how, you know, they did that and it really shaped who they are. So you can do it. And look at Fall Out Boy. Fall Out Boy,
sure.
You know, shocked the world with La Da Love, I'm on fire.
Yeah.
And it reshaped them into something different and that worked for them. But we are of the frame of mind now where we embrace where we came from. We understand, you know, that fans sort of like that about us. And the challenge, because it is a challenge, is to stick within those borders while still being current and still being creative. But how do we stick within those parameters and satisfy the fan base because that's who loves us.
Yeah.
And remain relevant, you know? So I like doing that now. And we've kind of, you know, like 2011 and then the following record, 2016, we really sort of like embrace that, like, you know, let's just be Simple Plan. And if we want to do something else, if I want to make a country record, then I'll make a country record and it won't be Simple Plan. You know, if I want to make a record that's going to sound more like Tame Impala, then I can do that and I can call it, you know, Pierre's Boutique, whatever, you know?
Yeah. I just think it's so frustrating when there's bands that, you know, won't play the hits. And it's like, dude, there's hundreds or thousands of people who came here and paid money that just want to see you play this song. And like, shouldn't you just be excited that anybody gives a shit about something you did 20 years ago?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I said, I maybe it's my Canadian nature. I don't like talking shit about anybody. But there are some bands out there that do that. We all know who they are.
Yeah.
It's not something I think is cool. It's, you know, I mean, all power to them if they want to do it. But I agree, you know, I mean,
but it doesn't make them happy. They're frustrated. You know, it's like they're fighting their fans, and it's like, you can do that if you want, but I just think it would be, they'd be happier people if they just practiced a little gratitude.
Yeah. Yeah.
Instead
totally.
Of being and, angry that people like something you did a long time ago.
Yeah. And the bottom line is that if a band is frustrated by the success of a certain song, my advice would be like, okay, I understand you don't want people shouting, you're like, play Creep or whatever they're going to say, you know, so play it in the beginning of the set, play the songs you don't want to play, knock them out. It'll take you 8 minutes, maybe 10, the three songs that you don't want to play, play those. Then the people that came to see them, maybe they'll walk away.
Fine.
And then everyone's happy, you know? So I think, you know, when we play a show, we play I'm Just a Kid every time, we play Perfect, we play I Do Anything, we play Addicted, we play all those Welcome to My Life, because I know that those songs mean a lot to some people. And like you said, I'm grateful that we've created those songs and that they connected with people. So
I thought it was cool. I saw you guys on the Sum 41 tour last year, and there was a woman in front of me who was just going crazy, and her friend, she had a little bit to drink, and her friend was like, I'm sorry. It's just, she's really excited because this is her first time away from her kids, you know, in months. And I thought that was awesome.
Yeah.
You know, that she's a mom now and that this still means so much to her and she's still having fun with these same songs. And for you guys to be able to give her that same feeling, you know, in her 30s as a mother is awesome.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting thing about being a band that has had longevity and, you know, lucky enough to have some continued success is to see people that, you know, I have to imagine that for some people, our first and second record back in those days in the early 2000s, that was their most, you know, significant musical, you know, their most significant albums they'd ever experienced or purchased.
Sure.
And that's, to me, that's incredible because, you know, we all have those artists that you look back at and you think like, when I grew up, you know, this record changed my life or whatever. And to be able to be that band for someone and see them grow up and the coolest thing oftentimes now, because we do like meet and greets and we'll have someone show up with a young child, you know, and it'll be like, you know, a 7-8 year old or whatever. And they're like, you know, this is my kid. And I grew up listening to your music and now my kid loves your music. So to some people now we've become that band that like, oh, my mom loved you. Or like, you're my mom's favorite band or my, and it's like, it's so weird. You know, so it goes into the bigger question of like what it feels like to get older, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, to be part of that, to be around long enough to see that happen, to be someone's parents' favorite band and they like them too. It feels like to me what it would be like for me to say to my dad, oh, I think the Beatles are awesome. He's like, oh, that was my favorite band, you know? And I'm not comparing Simple Plan to the Beatles. So, you know, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, the flip side of that, you've talked about this before in interviews about how much of backlash you got from the, you know, real punk people. I think I remember someone threw a bottle or something at you once. I would imagine that probably wasn't super fun. How did that feel at the time? Not just the bottle, but just in general, you know, all you guys and all those bands got so much shit.
Yeah, no, there was to set the record straight, I had thousands of bottles thrown at me in my career, but one landed in my face, which was strangely enough was in Canada. So in those days when, you know, Simple Plan, Good Charlotte, Sum 41, Newfound Glory, maybe less Newfound Glory, but all those bands that we kind of blew up and we were more poppy. There was a lot of hate. You know what I mean? I remember even the cover when we did the cover of all Alternative Press, the cover was about how much we were loved and hated, you know? So it was a big thing. And I remember we even like, whenever we thought about doing like festivals or certain things or who we'd play before or who we'd play after, it was always a discussion like, oh fuck man, we're going to get fucking killed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, if you got to play up to Rancid or something like that.
Yeah, it was interesting, but I think it kind of built some character into us, and like playing Warped Tour and like, you know, playing the smaller, we almost preferred playing the smaller stages because we knew that we'd only get people that wanted to come to see our band as opposed to the people that are like, fuck you,
right.
Friends No Effects, Pennywise is coming up, you know? But yeah, I mean, it was an interesting time, but yeah, it built some, you know, it actually gave us a bit of a chip on our shoulder, which fueled a lot of our creativity. But it's interesting. Yeah. I got hit in the face by a bottle in somewhere in Ontario in Canada. And it was a show that we were playing with Sum 41, oddly enough, but, we were playing a show. We were like 3/4 of the set done, and a bottle of like, you know, those like 500 milliliter bottles of like Coke with the bottle on the bottom like this. It was full or pretty full, and it was swung at me, I don't know how far, like hundreds of feet away, and it clocked me right in the face and cut my face. And I think it chipped a little bit of my bone here.
Yeah.
But I had to stop the show. I was almost knocked out. But I'm saying this because years later, you know, I have a cameo account where I do cameos for people. Someone said, hey, I want to get a cameo for this girl. She threw a bottle at you in Ontario like 15 years ago. And she feels so bad about it because she didn't actually intend on hitting you. It was just a mosh pit. And she was like, woo, you know, and socked me in the face. And it was so funny. So I did a cameo for this person. I was like, it's okay. I forgive you. It's all good.
And then he pressed charges. Like, see you in court.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
I was, it was really, really fun. But yeah, there was a time where there was a lot of mud, especially, you know, the funny thing, because success comes with hate, right? So
yeah,
we were playing Warped Tours, and whenever Warped Tour would go to Canada, which we were bigger in Canada because we're from Canada, that's where we'd get the most hate. So
interesting.
We kind of learned to, we learned to understand that if people really, 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 really hate you, it's because you're really, really, really popular. So, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listenersurvey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, I've even noticed that even for myself, and I'm obviously nowhere near as successful as you guys are, but even for me, it's like every time I open Reddit, there's some new thread about how much I suck. And it's like, oh, well, I guess this is just what happens when you start to do something that people pay attention to, then, you know.
Yeah, people get jealous or they get irritated that you are getting attention and they just want to slam you down. So,
yeah, I always thought it was so, like, so weird that all of you guys, but especially Simple Plan, would get any hate because all those bands were so nice, you know? And I feel like that's, there's a segment of people that don't like nice, that when you're nice, that makes them hate you more.
It's because you appear to be happy when you're right. nice, and they're clearly unhappy, and they're like, why are you so fucking happy? What are you smiling about?
Right. Why aren't you miserable like me?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's also, okay. I think that, you know, I think it begins in the adolescent age because what you like and what you don't like when you're a teenager, you know, is all you have. You live at your parents' house. They have to take you where you want to go. You can't buy your own shit because maybe you do have a job, but you can't buy everything. So what do you own? You own your taste. You own who you are by what you wear. You own, you identify as to, I don't like that. That's who I am. I like this. That's who I am. I wear this. That's who I am. So you develop a, you know, and you're trying desperately to separate yourself from your parents and what your house looks like, what your room looks like, what you're unable to control. So what you can control is to tell people what you like and what you dislike. So people get really passionate about that. And some people have trouble outgrowing that phase. And they just, you know.
Like if you look on the comments on Epitaph's Facebook page, that's my favorite. People in their 40s and 50s still doing that.
It's like, man, come on, dude. Come on. It's like, how about you just, you know, just, you don't like that. Let it go.
Yeah. Well, speaking of what you wear, you did your clothing brand Role Model for quite a while. Which I thought was really cool. That was kind of back in the era, you know, when the Blink guys were doing like Famous and Atticus and Macbeth, and there's probably some other ones I'm not thinking of. I thought that whole era was really cool and fun. What was that like for you guys? And is that something you would ever bring back?
It was super fun. You're absolutely right. We saw what Blink was doing. And I think that at the time, you know, all the bands like us and Newfound, all those people, we were all just walking posters for Billabong, for Hurley.
Yep.
And they were very simple shirts like I'm wearing today, you know, like that we felt like, hey, why are we promoting all these brands when we could do our own? And oftentimes we were going through stores looking for a certain shirt. Like, I want a shirt that looks like this. Like, well, let's just make one, you know? So seeing after Mark and Tom and Travis did their own lines, we're like, hey, we can do that. We create merch for Simple Plan. Let's just do something like that. And we had a guy that used to work for our band. He was kind of the sixth member of the band. His name was Pat, and he was our videographer, which we kind of emulated what Blink was doing. They had a guy back in the day called Cheetah who would do all their DVDs, and he'd follow the band everywhere. So Pat was our Cheetah, and he had the idea for Role Model. He's like, I have an idea for a clothing brand. It's going to be called Role Model. We should do it all together. And we're like, okay, cool. We did it. It was super fun. And I'm a little bit bummed because it became quite successful. We were in Hot Topic and we had some cool stuff. We talked about doing a deal with this guy that didn't work out in Montreal to do like more elaborate clothing designs. But there was a company, I think in the UK, that is still around called Role Model Clothing. And it is they make scrubs. They make stuff for like, you know, medical stuff or, you know, different things unrelated to Role Model Clothing that we're doing. And for some reason they found out about our success and they came after us and they had the means to sort of, you know, make a cease and desist and all that stuff. So we looked into buying the name and copywriting it and getting them out or trying to fight it, you know, in the legal system. And it became very costly. And at that point, it was during the third album when we were like, no, we don't want to look like that anymore. Now we want to wear stuff that's more sophisticated, you know? Yeah. So
skinny ties.
Yeah, exactly. So those two things combined, the fact that we were constantly being harassed by this company that wanted to sue us and the fact that our style was changing, we just said, you know what, guys, let's stop doing this. But yeah, I'd love to bring it back. It was super fun. I liked doing it. Chuck was a big part of it as well. Him and I did it. And there's a bit of a demand for it. So it would be cool to do something. I think it's a great name still.
Yeah.
You know, whether you take it, you know, sarcastically or seriously, I think it's a good name. So we'll see. I we've talked about it many times. I think there's a lot of things that we'd like to do, but you know, we're all older guys now. All of us have children. We all have different things, and sometimes there's only a certain amount of hours in a day that you can dedicate to creativity. So, but yeah, we'd love to do it. We'd love to do it.
I feel like if you just brought back some of the like classic designs, like now is the perfect time to do that.
Yeah, we did it on our, so there was on our anniversary tour, the 15th anniversary tour for No Pads, which happened in 2017. We reissued the Role Model number 9 shirt. That was my shirt. And I wore it every night. And I threw it in the crowd every night, and we sold it at the merch stand. So we did that. So yeah, we just don't use the name Role Model Clothing Company anymore. So.
I see. Right. Yes. Right. Cause you can't.
Cause that dumb company that somehow thinks we're a threat. I don't understand.
Yeah. Another thing you had back then that I thought was really fun was, you had the MTV show Damage Control, which I seem to remember being part of the same block as like Punk'd and Viva La Bam, if I recall correctly. What was that experience like? I think it was like 2 seasons or something.
It was awful.
Wow. Okay.
So it was, I'm very grateful. I can't believe I had a show on MTV. I loved that aspect of it. I think it was really cool. I think the people I worked with were amazing. I think that I'm just have so much gratitude for that experience. I think financially it was great for me. They paid me really well. But at the time I really didn't have time to do it. Like I was on tour around the world all the time, and, I was exhausted and I had to come back. Sometimes I was on tour and I had to like, I remember this one time, I think I was in Southeast Asia or Japan or something, and I had to go back and shoot a show and come back to Asia to keep going on tour. And it was that time in the band's career where everything was just so busy. And like I said, I'd love to rewind and like be smarter and more adult about it. And like maybe drink less, maybe like party less and focus more. But I appreciated the opportunity on every level, but I was so burnt out. And I look back, I don't even think I want to watch that show, because I just remember just being like, it was like 4 a.m. calls, you know, I wasn't that well experienced at being a host. And sometimes I'd go drinking out the night before and I'd have to wake up and talk to these parents, and like there's hidden cameras and shit going on. And I'm like, oh my God, I want to barf and my head hurts.
Yeah.
And I gotta go and do a show tomorrow night somewhere else. So it was a tough, tough experience. I don't think I was very good at it. I think I could have put more effort into it, and I could have focused more. And when I think back of Damage Control, that's what is my biggest takeaway. But like I said, nothing to do with MTV or the people that were there. The producer, who's still a friend of mine, I see him once every few years. I had a great experience there. The whole staff, everyone was so, so nice.
So as I recall, the premise of the show is that parents would say that they're going away for the weekend or whatever, and you would have hidden cameras on the kids at home to see what they were doing. Is that what it was?
Yeah. So it's basically based on Punk'd. But yeah, so basically, you know, if you had a friend of yours and you're younger and you know, you're friends with his parents or whatever, or his or her parents, you'd be like, hey, there's a show called Damage Control. We're going to, you know, we want you guys to leave the house. The parents leave the house and rig up the house with some hidden cameras, which is a challenge. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then while the parents are gone, they make crazy shit happen. So it's not like we're trying to catch the kids, you know, doing drugs or, you know, hooking up with their boyfriend or girlfriend. It's more like we're going to leave for the weekend and then crazy stuff happens, you know, like, you know, whatever that may have been. There was just, it's all such a blur, but yeah, it was one of those hidden things. And then the kids would freak out. And then the parents would have to like run in. And while I'm like hidden camera, like, Hey, it's okay. This is a show called Damage Control. And some of the people were like, who the fuck are you? I don't know Simple Plan. I wasn't Ashton Kutcher. And it wasn't like, I couldn't say Punk'd. You've been Punk'd. You know, it had
you've
to
been
be
damage
else.
Controlled. Just
yeah, you've
quite,
been damage
yeah.
controlled. Yeah. But it was, there was some fun times there, but that was the premise. It was kind of like a Punk'd show, but when kids kids' parents would go away, and then, you know, craziness would ensue.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I got to ask you about, maybe my favorite pop culture moment of that whole era, was you guys were in the Mary-Kate and Ashley movie, New York Minute. And for anybody who hasn't seen it, the plot of the movie is that they skip school so that one of them can give a copy of their demo to Simple Plan. And what was amazing about it to me is, like, you know, that you guys were an actual, you just didn't have a song in the movie. It wasn't a cameo. Like, you were the actual central focus of the plot.
Yeah, it's crazy.
How did that happen, and what was that like?
Again, part of that big blur in the first few years, it was we were successful. We were a multi-platinum selling artist, and, you know, we had a great record label that was pushing in different departments to get these types of deals. And I think this was probably, I'm not sure, probably one of Kevin Weaver's deals. But yeah, we were like, you know, we'd opened up for Avril Lavigne. We'd done a bunch of big things on the pop market. We were doing Scooby-Doo things. And that opportunity came about with Mary-Kate and Ashley. And at that point, I remember we were so, like, because in the beginning, there were certain decisions that we made as a band that we were like, okay, do we want to go that pop? Because we know we're going to get some heat from it, such as opening for Avril Lavigne. That was it, because K-Rock was playing our single. We were on MTV, but it was like we were kind of cool still. But that Mary-Kate and Ashley movie, at that point, we knew, like, okay, we've already done Avril. We've done all this stuff. Like, let's just keep pushing. We just want to be in front of as many people as possible. And we know that Mary-Kate and Ashley are massive. And so we did that. It was super fun. They were really cool. We were on the set for 3 days. We shot basically a show where it's in the movie. And it was a good time. And to this day, we play shows and a lot of people say that they discovered our band through New York Minute. So I think it was a great thing. It was cool. And, is it a little cheesy? Absolutely. You know,
I mean, American Pie is cheesy as hell. It's like, I don't know why people pretend like those teen movies are some sort of like.
Yeah. Let's just say that Mary-Kate and Ashley is a lot less, is a lot more G-rated than sure. American Pie, but still, yeah. I mean, it's all part of it. And if you don't like it, you don't have to watch it, you know,
but I thought it was awesome.
Yeah. No, it was cool. It was a fun little movie and it was a great experience.
And Dr. Drew was in the movie as well. Another one of my
favorite
movies.
That's right.
Moments. Playing
forgot
himself.
About that. He was in the movie. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. And I love Dr. Drew. He's amazing.
Yeah, man. Loveline changed my life.
My wife is a massive fan of his. Though it's funny. We met him once. He was at a country club dinner that we went to at some point in LA at some country club. And he was there. We've been drinking a little bit, my wife and I. This is years ago, and she was like, "It's Dr. Drew over there. I'm gonna go tell him he's awesome." And she went over there and was like, "I love you. You're the coolest." And he was like, "Thank you, very much."
I got him to sign one of my books, a copy of his book in the day, and it was
awesome.
my prized possession. I said, "Drew, look, I want you to say I bought the hardback, not the soft cover, because I wanted you to get paid more." And he said, "I did notice. Thank you."
He's a genius. I think he's a very, very incredibly smart man.
Yeah, he is. Well, last thing I wanted to ask you about, which was one of your newer songs, Best Day of My Life, which really resonated with me because I spend a lot of my energy trying to control my own kind of psychology and stay grateful and kind of stay in that place. Can you tell me a little bit about that song and what inspired you to write it?
I think that... it's a song, you know, that we want to write about because I think that, you know, when we made that record, we wrote that song probably 3 years ago. Sometimes, you know, when you get older and a little more mature, you realize that, like, you know, you focus a lot on negativity. You focus a lot on like what you could have, what you don't have, or what you want to get to. And Chuck and I, who write the songs together, sometimes we have to, like, you know, kind of bring ourselves back to reality and look at our lives. You know what I mean? Like, I have a wonderful life. I've been incredibly successful. I have a beautiful home. I got a beautiful family. I haven't had to have a job since Simple Plan. This is my only job. It's my career. It pays for all the bills. My kids have a wonderful life. And so we were inspired by that.
And the chickens.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, life is good. So we were inspired by that thought and sort of like, wanted to use the song as a reminder of, like, you know, I'm going to live like this is the best day of my life. This is going to, I'm going to focus on the good things. And I love the lyrics in that chorus. To me, we wrote that song. It was Chuck and I and our friend, Nate Campany, awesome songwriter. And I was like, all together, we were like, we should write a song that every line in the chorus is sort of like an idiom about you know, sort of glass half full type thing, you know, so yeah, it's just a song about focusing on the positivity in your life and just living like you're having a good time, you know, and focus on the good things.
Cool. Well, I will let you go. I know you got a busy day. Thank you so much for making time for this. And yeah, I will see you next time you come through Seattle.
Awesome. It's a pleasure. Thank you for all that you do, and enjoy the rest of your day. And we'll catch you on the flip side.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.
Hello, Tom May here, host of Future Friday. I've spent the last 15 years on the road with my band, The Menzingers, where I've met all kinds of wild and fascinating people. So I started a podcast. On Future Friday, I talk to fellow musicians about the moments that made them, their passions outside of music, and the curiosities that tie us all together. I've also talked to the likes of UFO researchers, magicians, soldiers, and documentary filmmakers, and I'm constantly searching for folks that can shape and change our view of the world. You can check out Future Friday wherever you like.